Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
As a fellow Yimby centrist dad, I could not agree. Well, except I'm not really centrist anymore. I'm like, everyone else has moved more, so far to the right, I'm now wildly left wing. But, you know, I used to be centrist.
Welcome to The Power Test. I'm Aisha Hazarika.
And I'm Sam Friedman.
Welcome to the Power Test with myself, Aisha Hazarika, and Sam Friedman. And it's been a very, very exciting week for political nerds because, of course, we have had those local elections. Now, everybody wants a general election, but I have to say, Sam, I was quite excited by these local elections. They sort of had a bit of a feel of a general election night, actually.
Yeah, I think we were all sort of just having a sort of rehearsal. But also, because the results were over 3 days, it felt like a sort of festival. It was for nerds, a festival for nerds.
It's like an Indian wedding. I loved it. Just went on and on.
But just, you know, the amount of Haribo, Pringles and Coke I went through over 3 days. You know, I probably funded those companies for the next year.
You probably saved them from a sugar tax.
I had a great time. It was fascinating because also you've got lots of different types of elections and loads of results to think about and go through. So for anyone who loves this kind of thing, which I appreciate is not everybody, it was a very, very interesting 3 days. And we saw some really interesting results, which we can get into in more detail. But I think the top line is, you know, it's basically what you'd have expected from the national polls. You know, it was a very, very bad night for the Conservatives, which you'd expect for a party that are averaging 20 points behind. Wherever you look, you know, they did badly in council elections, lost around half their councillors, did badly in mayoral elections where they lost all but one, Ben Houchen holding on in Tees Valley, but with a big swing, 17-point swing against him. Even in sort of the police crime and commissioner elections, which people weren't paying so much attention to, you know, they did very badly. Labour won 10 of those off the Conservatives as well in places that you don't necessarily associate with Labour doing particularly well. So, you know, all in all, it was a really bad night. And what was really remarkable is that Labour made gains in places that are way, way, way down their target list of seats. Places like Rushmore Council, which is an Aldershot Westminster constituency. Places like Cannock Chase, places like Redditch. These places have 17,000 plus majorities for the Tories. And if Labour are doing well there, that is a big, big flashing red flag. So yeah, there really wasn't much for them to hold on to.
And yet they did cling on to some weird hope because, I mean, I, like you, I was up for a vast amount of time commentating on these results. And one of the things that I was really struck by was the number of, you know, journalists, even when we were kind of well into the sort of Friday and the Saturday going, bit of a tricky set of results for Labour. And you were like, I was like, look, listen, I'm of course biased, but I'm the first person to call Labour out when they've had a bit of a stinker. This was not one of those occasions. And it's quite interesting. I feel like this set of local results, and this is like the final pit stop on the way to that general election, which I think is now definitely going to be in January 2025.
I think it'll be a bit before that, but probably not much before.
Listen, I think Rishi's going into full lockdown. I think he's going to, you know, those people that like stockpile for like a nuclear war and things like that.
We're going to have to get him out of Downing Street. We're going to have to send in the bailiffs.
Exactly, exactly. But I do think it was a little bit of a precursor to just the ludicrous expectation management and some of the kind of slightly ludicrous lines that are going to run out as we head towards the short campaign, going, oh, it's looking pretty tight for Labour. Every chance of a hung parliament here. I think John Swinney's going to have to prop them up. You know what I mean? You can just see a quite wild narrative developing, which is not rooted in any reality.
And I think it's because they need there to be a contest, right? They're trying to make it interesting to normal people who aren't listening to podcasts like ours. And if you just keep saying, well, Labour are going to win, I mean, that's what everything's pointing. Obviously, stuff can change, stuff can happen. But right now, Labour are still looking like they're going to win. It's sort of quite boring. So they have to sort of pretend there's some drama and there's some risk in there. And also, I think there's a sort of sense of not quite pity for the Conservatives, but a sense that you have to give them something and have to throw something negative at Labour in order to make it a bit fair. Mm. So you sort of see these lines about, oh, it'll be a hung parliament, which I don't think anybody really believes, even Rishi Sunak. But you have to sort of go along with because you have to have something to say.
Well, certainly with my media hat on, we need some mild peril. There's got to be some jeopardy, right? There has to, because it's not good for business if everything is. And also it does help Labour in a way, because the biggest thing that all the strategists are terrified of is this complacency thing. Look, it was a glowing set of results for Labour, but the dark cloud on the horizon is, of course, the situation with Gaza. And we will get into that during the rest of the podcast. Well, let's introduce our very special guest for this week's episode of The Power Test. We are delighted to welcome Rob Ford. Rob is Professor of Political Science at the University of Manchester. He's also author of the book Sex, Lies and the Ballot Box. And he was part of the BBC team analysing those very exciting local election results. Rob, welcome.
Pleasure to be here.
I want to ask a bit about what it's like being part of the BBC team. Like, what are you all doing? Are you sort of locked in a room with John Curtis where he's sort of bossing you around?
People would pay good money for that, by the way, to be locked in a room with John Curtis having bought people. That's like quite a specialist thing people would pay money for.
But what happens in the room where all of this analysis is going on?
Well, we kind of are locked in a room with John Curtis and a bunch of other very talented BBC journalists. It's more like a floor, actually, of New Broadcasting House than a room. We have one corner of it. There's a team of about five or six of us who are the sort of imported cephalological nerds. We do 3 days of rehearsals as well. So if you think 3 days is a festival of local election counting, imagine adding another 3 days onto that. And we also spend chunks of time over the course of several months ahead of time preparing all sorts of mega data sets and mega spreadsheets. The sort of approach we take is John will select a bunch of councils that go into what the BBC call the key wards. It's about 810 wards this time. And we basically throw everything at those statistically to try and figure out what's going on as the night is progressing so that we can pick out some of the key stories in what's going on, sometimes gently prod various talking heads on air with evidence that perhaps what they're saying isn't quite in line with what the results are actually showing. Also just sort of flesh out the story for everybody. So there's a big sort of console that everybody working with the election has got in front of them that has a tab on it that is called Curtis Analysis. So that's where John writes up all of the stuff that we're finding in the data. He obviously pops up regularly himself on the TV as well. But even when he isn't, all the BBC correspondents who are working the show can see little stories popping up there that they can then hopefully make use of to fill out their coverage and challenge their guests and stuff. Mm. I mean, it's tremendously good fun.
And the most important question that our listeners will want to know, Rob, is what's the kind of sugar and snack strategy for that part? How much sugar did you mainline? What was your snack of choice to get you through the night?
I'm more partial to crisps than sugar. And I have to say the BBC are very good hosts in this regard. There were big trays of sandwiches, crisps and various forms of sugary snacks that are refreshed on a distressingly regular basis. There's no Haribo, I'm afraid, Sam. But I mean, apart from that, if you want to remain well topped up with carbs and sugary snacks, the BBC have got you covered.
So the thing that really, really interested me, and this has been true of the last couple of cycles, is the rise of the Green Party. They are doing extremely well, and it hasn't been discussed very much. in the sort of media in the way that the rise of reform has been discussed, because it's not quite so visible in national polls, but you know, across two sets of general elections now, they've really added a lot of councillors. If you look at the set of councils we had last week, you know, they now have a third as many councillors as the Tories in those councils, which is kind of remarkable for a party that has never had that strong a council base in the country before. There's the biggest party in some quite big councils like Bristol. You know, I think we all agree that's not going to be replicated exactly in a general election. And that's one of the reasons why you can't compare local and general election results so easily. But what does it presage for Labour? What does this sort of rise in green strength in local elections tell us about how the electorate are now behaving and thinking?
Well, I mean, first of all, I agree with you. It's one of the most under-discussed stories in not just this local election cycle, but the last three or four local election cycles. I think in every write-up of local elections I've done since 2019, I've had at least a paragraph where I've said, well, this is another strong set of local elections for the Greens. Something seems to be happening here. So this isn't a flash in the pan. It's been going on for a number of years. It's also very clear what the kind of political sociology of this Green support is. I mean, they are picking up some votes in Conservative areas. It's worth pointing that out. But, you know, they do best in Labour areas. They do best in graduate areas. They do best in Remain areas. They do best in urban areas. We can see what this is. It's a challenge to Labour on its progressive left flank. And it's a challenge that now has a serious and credible base in local governments. So I do think that round about a year or two from now, if you're continuing, I don't know if you still call it the power test once they actually are in government, if we're doing this in May 2026, we'll be like, oh my goodness, look at all these Green councillors all the way across these Labour councils. What does this mean? Is it going to pull Starmer to the left and so on? And there'll be a lot of people who've ignored this in parts of the press who are getting very, very worked up about reform, who'll be like, oh my God, what's happened here? This is new. But it's not actually. It's been going on for a while. Mm. And what I think it does point to, which we also see in, you know, the opinion polling and the political science surveys and stuff like this, is the left as we conceive it now is a much less partisan left than it used to be. It's a broad tent, a big tent that includes a lot of people whose relationship to the Labour Party is much more transactional than emotional. These are not partisan Labour voters. These are voters who are going to be willing to consider other options. We know they're going to be willing to consider other options because they are actively endorsing other options in other elections already. And I think that will pose probably a steadily growing problem for Starmer once he's in government, because right now we're at a very, very anti-incumbent moment in the cycle. And another thing we saw in the locals is the tactical voting levels are really, really high. And this is true of Green voters as well. The Greens do much worse where they're, you know, where it's a Conservative held ward with Labour or the Lib Dems second. Greens do worse, which suggests they're piling in behind whoever the local challenger is. But once the Conservatives are out of government, that anti-incumbent dynamic, I suspect, will dissipate quite quickly. And these voters who are already telling us in local elections, you know what, we prefer what the Greens have to offer to what Keir Starmer has to offer. I don't think it's going to take very long for a lot of them to start saying the same thing in general election opinion polling and in by-elections and in local elections to come.
So just to, I suppose, be the slightly annoying punter in all of this, I totally hear what you're saying. And I interviewed the Greens on my show and they were making exactly this point. What a lot of people, though, think, a lot of people who are not in the kind of weeds of all the data and following all the kind of councils like you two are, is it's highly unlikely that the Greens are going to win loads of seats at the general election. They're a great destination point at a local election if you're kind of pissed off with Labour and you don't want to vote for the Tories. Caroline Lucas is probably the best known Green in the country. She's stepping down at the next general election. Isn't it the case that one of the reasons the Greens gets less coverage is because people don't feel they can inflict that much damage at this stage when it matters at a parliamentary election, whereas people think reform can do the Tories a lot of damage?
Yeah, I think that's true. And to be honest, I largely agree with that assessment. I think there's a paradox about both the Greens and Reform. So Greens did, you know, much better than Reform in these local elections. But as you say, the threat they pose at the general election, it's not really there. And I think that's one way in which people are, you know, making a rational inference from these local elections to the general election. Whereas Reform, very weak, in many respects, underperformed on some indicators in these local elections. But because the Conservatives' vote is so low now, and because they're so exposed to a challenge on their kind of Brexity anti-immigration right, they punch way above their weight in the general election. The attention being on the latter at this point makes a lot of sense. But I think what is important and new about where we are now, with the Greens having quadrupled the number of councillors they have on the councils up and down the country in the past 5 years, is you've got a real prospect of them taking a bunch of councils from Labour in the coming Labour Parliament, a real prospect of them being a major headache at by-elections. And I don't think we have any real precedent for what that will mean. If we're looking towards the general election, and unless you're Tangham Debonair, and if you're Tangham Debonair, I think you've got to be really very worried about your prospects in Bristol Central, or you're the Bristol Labour Party. And of course, if you're the Brighton Labour Party, you're going to be worried about the Greens and have been for a while. Elsewhere in the country, you're right. The only real question with the Greens is how much of their support is going to come back into the Labour column. Other than that, they don't have a particular relevance, and reform are much more relevant for the fate of many Conservative MPs. But in the course of the next Labour Parliament, I suspect we are going to see something new. In the past, in the last Labour government, it was the Lib Dems who really made hay in local government and in by-elections as the kind of anti-incumbent voice sort of on the left. In the coming parliament, I suspect the Greens are going to play that role in a pretty big way.
Aisha, I'm quite interested in your sort of perspective on this from the Labour Party political strategy point of view, because Starmer's done very well by tacking to the centre, by winning back a lot of voters, or at least no longer scaring a lot of voters who might have been scared by Jeremy Corbyn. If you start getting pressure on the left from the Greens, maybe from independent groups as well, how is that going to affect how Starmer's sort of policy agenda and how they think about policy in the next parliament?
I think it's a really, really interesting question. And I think up until now, and probably actually for the foreseeable future, I think their strategy has been so clear cut, which is absolutely winning back the red wall, every single kind of cue or optical symbol or signal that Keir Starmer sends out. It's all about the kind of red wall. It's that sort of traditional, older, you know, socially conservative voter. You know, it's quite telling that every message is about the red wall, the flags, the patriotism, I love my country, the tour of the kind of non-league football grounds, like the centrist dad kind of, like every bit of symbolism is kind of really, I think, geared up to quite a small group of people, which is like, we're not going to scare the horses on this. We love the flag. We love football. We love family. We're like uber, uber, uber traditional. And I think they'll be a bit in denial about what's happening, about these votes going to Greens and obviously some independents. Some people in the Labour Party will be thinking, look, this is just a Gaza problem. And when Gaza gets sorted out, everything will just return back to normal and we're not going to change our strategy because we've just got to get over the line. And that's the kind of direction of travel for the Labour Party. But I think there are others that are, particularly a lot of candidates as well, who are really quite worried about what happens going forward, because their view is this is not just about the Muslim vote. This is about actually a generation of young people who've been quite politicised by what's happening in the Middle East at the moment. There's a group of people who, even though Starmer has changed his position on a ceasefire and David Lammy now is talking quite tough, they'll never forgive Starmer for that original LBC interview that he did. For me, the big flare of danger down the track is, as Rob was saying, you know, a much more kind of, because the left in the party kind of don't have anywhere to go at the moment. They're quite boxed in. But if there is this kind of building up outside for more left-wing policies, they'll come under pressure. And the big flare is foreign policy is going to be, I think, really tricky.
Yeah, I mean, you can see foreign policy is going to be an area. And I agree with you. I think the frustrations around Gaza are more a symptom of wider frustrations with Labour than they are a thing in itself. And it would be a mistake to think this is going to go away if and when that horrific situation is resolved. But if I'm, you know, a new Labour MP in Hastings or Stroud or places like that, where the Greens are coming on very strong, and I'm in a Labour government that is being tough on benefits because that's what, you know, the newspapers want us to do, you know, they're not spending money on the NHS, they're talking about reform instead, I'm going to start getting nervous pretty quickly that I'm going to lose my voter base. So you sort of get this potential for dissent within the parliamentary party, I think, and that could emerge relatively fast, albeit that people will be balancing that with their desire for ministerial jobs and so on. So foreign policy is definitely a potential flashpoint, but you could see sort of lots of other policy flashpoints around areas where Blair got to be quite socially conservative whilst also giving lots of money to the public services and so on, because actually his voter coalition was pretty much in line with the British public on some social issues, whereas Starmer's voter coalition is going to be, I think, to the left of where Blair's were.
Rob, I mean, in terms of when you look at stresses and challenges that a new Labour government could face, I mean, to Sam's point there, you're going to have a very new, fresh parliamentary Labour Party. Everyone's going to be vying for jobs, and Starmer will be very powerful right at the beginning because one always is. But it feels like he will be under pressure quite quickly on a number of fronts, whether it's, as Sam said, more money for the NHS, the unions wanting, you know, to come and discuss, you know, pay increases. How do you think, given this less factional, more transactional sort of left, how do you think they will navigate this more fractured left when they come in?
The big risk, and it's a big unknown really as well, is how quickly will the polling turn against Labour once they're in office? You know, one of the ways in which we're in a different world to 97 is I think that the Starmer median position is to the left of where Blair was. That's certainly true. But I think the median left voter now, or the median voter to the left of Starmer, is much less partisan towards Labour than the median left voter was in 1997. And so the risk is you're actually delivering more on the left, but it's still not enough for voters who are much more transactional and much less patient than they were in the past. I think one substantial risk is that the polling may fall for Labour more quickly than they're anticipating. I was remembering, looking at the fact that the local elections this year had their baseline as May 2021, was a stark reminder of the fact that in the spring and summer of 2021, there were a lot of people who were talking about 10 years of Conservative government, who were talking about, you know, the great toad squatting in the centre ground of British politics, etc., etc. You know, there were 10, 15% polling leads for the Conservatives seemingly stretching out forever, and that's just changed very, very fast. Now, of course, a lot of sins of commission by the government in question, maybe Labour will avoid those. But the point is, voters are impatient. They're not partisan. They can often be swift to move. And what we are already seeing in these local elections is we're seeing the Labour vote down on 2024 in the most Remain places, in the most graduate-heavy places, in the most ethnically diverse places, down on last year. So that movement away is already starting before they're even in government, at least in these local elections. And I wonder how they will react as an incoming government that's very inexperienced if the polls move very fast. I mean, we've seen how Conservative MPs have reacted with what often looks like blind, directionless panic when the polling has gone down for them. There will be a lot of inexperienced MPs in here. If they see the Labour poll lead drop from, you know, 20 points to 10 points to 5 points, will they keep their nerve? Will the team around Starmer keep their nerve and say, well, you know, this happens at midterm, happened to Blair at midterm, although it didn't in the first term. We just got to stay the course. Or will it result in some panicky changes of course, some efforts to appease various groups that seem to be particularly annoyed? Will we see again something we've seen in this parliament, some overreactions to particular by-election results or local election results? Volatility seems to me like one of the certainties of the politics we have today. But I'm not sure how well politicians who have not been in government for a while have priced in what that's going to look like and feel like once they're in government.
And Sam, I think that scenario is incredibly likely. If there's like a lot of challenge to Labour when they're first in, there's poll drops, you can see a narrative developing. What do you think that does to the kind of opposition forces, the Conservative Party in opposition, a very active media as well? There'll be, you know, the kind of right-wing media will be sort of gunning for Starmer, you know, GB News, all that sort of thing. I mean, how do you think they will react to that? And how do you think Labour will rise to that challenge?
I think the real problem they're going to have from a sort of political strategy point of view is it's going to be coming from both sides. So you're going to have the right-wing media, you're going to have whatever the Tory party become after the election, you're going to still probably have a Reform Party, all pushing very hard on, you know, immigration is still way too high, crime, you're letting all these people get too many benefits, you know, all of their sort of old tunes. And in some parts of the country, they're going to be the main opposition. And then you're going to have Green Party, maybe the Lib Dems to some degree, saying, you know, you're being as harsh and cruel as the Tories, you know, different to them. You're also a bunch of, you know, evil capitalist bastards. And they're going to get caught in the middle of that. And you're going to have MPs going, can we be a bit nicer and a bit more Labour-y? Because I'm about to lose my seat to the Greens, and you're going to have other MPs going, I've got reform on my back. Can we please say something about immigration? And it's just going to create this sort of incredible fracturing of this coalition, which they've brought together around a sort of deep frustration with 14 years of Tory government. And it's just going to be incredibly hard to hold that together. And it's going to be even harder to maintain a consistent policy course through that, because you're going to be being dragged in two different directions politically. So it's going to require an incredible amount of resilience from Starmer and his team to see that off. And it's kind of why I keep coming back to this sort of, I know they don't want to rush into stuff, and I know they want to be careful, and that's the right thing to feel. But if they don't do some of the difficult stuff early, you start getting bad by-election results, you start getting bad council results, it gets harder and harder to do the difficult stuff. So I worry about leaving the hard stuff and say, oh, we'll do it in the second term.
And if the majority is really big for Labour, which is a good thing in many ways, but there's also a slight downside with that. If the majority is so big, you get more pressure from the left as well, just saying like, why don't you do everything now? You're never going to be as strong. And Rob, I wonder what these regional mayors will do, because they're quite a powerful force now in British politics. You know, they've really cleaned up at these elections. They've watched Andy Burnham kind of become the poster boy for, you know, the King of the North and all of that sort of stuff. Do you think these regional mayors, will they be a powerful new caucus in British politics for Labour?
I expect so. And I was actually an early supporter of this kind of city region model of devolution for precisely this reason. My expectation was ambitious big hitters would go for these roles, and these roles would create a platform for big ambitious politicians to essentially argue for the thing that is most needed, in my view, in British politics, which is to wrestle more money and control away from Whitehall. We still have the most fiscally centralized polity in Western Europe, Western world, in many respects in policy formulation too. And that's already started to happen. I mean, I'm speaking to you from Greater Manchester, where we've seen a number of cycles already of this kind of ratchet effect of devolution, which we saw also with Scotland and Wales. And I think when you've got a big caucus of Labour mayors who are seen as big voices within the party, they'll be like governors are within the Democratic Party in some respects. What they're doing will be watched, what they're saying will be watched, what they're asking for will be watched, and there'll be a lot of pressure in the centre to offer that kind of stuff, not least because that's something Labour have said they want to be ambitious on in the coming Parliament as well. I think the risk with that, though, which still isn't being discussed so much, is this piecemeal model is also going to come under a lot of pressure, because you've got a situation now where half of England has a city region mayor and half of it doesn't. And some of the parts that are left maybe have a logical unit for devolution and some don't. But some places are already poor relations in this regard. And if the city region mayors prove to be an effective caucus, they'll become even poorer relations. And the lack of any kind of coherent overall logic to the process will start to become, I fear, rather more obvious, and may well become a source of considerable discontent for example, MPs who represent areas that don't have a city region mayor. They're going to feel pretty left out in that process. So I think they will be, but I think that brings its own tensions, not just between Westminster and the mayors, but also between the mayors and the places that don't have mayors.
And that's quite an interesting point, because I mean, everywhere can have a mayor if they want it, but you've got quite a lot of councils, particularly Tory councils in the south, that have been quite resistant to the idea of losing some of their power and bringing in a mayor. And you can see them sort of coming under more and more pressure to do that, which is kind of a good thing in a way, but you may get to a point where Labour government have to say, actually, we're just going to impose them on every part of the country because they've become such an important part of our governance model. And then you do really have a kind of regional level of British government that we've never had before. And you start to get into questions like, do you need a way for those people to come together and be represented? Do they need, those people need to be in the Lords? You start to get into those kinds of questions, Aisha, that you considered with Gordon Brown in his report on constitutional reform. So it is a really important development. We can sort of talk about what all this means for Westminster, but the mayors becoming these key figures, it does really matter for British politics.
What's fascinating about the kind of birth of the modern mayor, and particularly something like Andy Burnham and, of course, Sadiq Khan in London, that happened because they were both two really ambitious men. They were staring down the barrel of a Jeremy Corbyn-led Labour Party for the foreseeable future with no chance of having any power. So they sort of thought, right, we're going to try our luck somewhere else. What's so interesting about them and others is that it does feel like it's one bit of politics which really rewards somebody who's got a big, big personality, is a bit of a media show pony, and quite enjoys challenging their own party as well. They quite enjoy being the insurgent against everybody, against Westminster, against their own party. I just wonder if there are Conservatives right now who are looking at the future and thinking maybe they'll do a Sadiq and an Andy Byrne, and maybe they, I mean, we saw a little bit with Ben Bradley, right? I mean, he didn't win in the East Midlands with Clare Ward. But I wonder if maybe the route for ambitious future Tories is to try and actually, you know, swing for a mayoral seat.
And there's going to be plenty of Tories losing their seats who want to find a way back into politics after this election. Some pretty big names are going to lose their seats.
Labour's going to have a tough time. There's going to be plenty to sort of rail against. Now, we've talked a lot about Labour. We talked a lot about Greens and the Reform Party. What about the Lib Dems, Rob? Because I kind of feel like they've been, again, quite quiet, but they actually had, you know, they got some good results, Tunbridge Wells, but they don't really seem to get much airtime either. What's going on with the Lib Dems?
There were a number of more headline-grabbing things going on, and the Lib Dems unfortunately got rather left behind because it was a sort of very Lib Dem-y sort of boring progress story. You know, they won where they needed to win, they squeezed the vote where they needed to win, but ultimately that is no longer a surprise in the way that it was a surprise in 2022 or 2021, for example. So when we looked in the detail of our key wards, you could see that they were doing better where they were second place to the Conservatives. They're doing better in a lot of the areas where they're targeting Westminster seats, but often they already control the councils in those areas after the last couple of very strong results. So I think that all got rather washed out of the headlines. Also, they were down somewhat from their sort of score last year on the projected national vote share. And you know, they don't seem to be advancing quite as dramatically as they were a few years ago, levelling off a bit. But they're levelling off at a level that will really worry a lot of Conservative MPs in the southeast of England. There are a number of places that now look very, very yellow at local government level and have Conservative MPs with majorities that can't feel safe in the current environment. And we know how the Lib Dems have made use of that in the past. When they've got a very strong presence in local government, that's a lot more people to push the leaflets through the doors and a lot more direct experience for people of, actually, if you vote for Lib Dems here, Lib Dems get elected. It's a centrist dad story of undramatic progress where they need to make it. But I think the big question for me, when you look at things like Tunbridge Wells, is how big a target list are they going to have? Because they have relatively limited financial and organisational resources, and they're now going to start hearing the siren calls again of, oh, maybe we can win 50 seats, maybe we can win 70 seats, maybe we should aim a bit higher. I wonder how that conversation is going, whether they're going to remain very disciplined and focused on a quite narrow set of easier targets.
Yeah, there is a sort of weird scenario, sort of non-zero chance that Ed Davey ends up being leader of the opposition just because the Tories get completely hammered and absolutely no one's put any attention whatsoever to their policies or positions on anything.
Think of the stunts. Think of the props department.
I don't know what would actually happen in that scenario. Like, it doesn't feel like there's enough difference between Lib Dems and Labour for that to actually work in a parliamentary democracy. I think we'll probably leave that possibility until it actually, and worry about that one when it happens.
This will be the coalition that people really want, which is another reason why I think this, like, Tory line that came out about a hung parliament, you know, kind of a parliament of coalition chaos. That's the worst message to send out. There's loads of people like, oh, I'd love a coalition between the Lib Dems and the Labour Party. Oh, I'll just vote for Lib Dems. Why don't I? Mean, that's like the worst messaging from the Conservatives.
And also, you hear chaos, you just need to reply with a picture of Liz Truss and you've sort of won the argument. So, I mean, it's sort of, chaos is just not a word I would be using at all if I was a Conservative in this election.
And I wouldn't be saying, you know, I mean, if you're Jeremy Hunt or Michael Gove, or, you know, in all those areas, you're not very happy to hear, oh, the Lib Dems could be really important in the next parliament. Yes. They'll put that straight on their leaflets.
Yeah, not so good. The other thing that I was thinking, and I don't know what you two think about this, is that you're right that Labour had a pretty good night, but you could argue, you know, they're not doing as well as they, you know, was under Blair, and, you know, all this chat about a hung parliament. That's actually super helpful to them because, like, their big thing is, their big message that they're sending out to everybody, their briefing leader writers constantly is, we might not win, we've got to keep on our toes. Rob, is this not quite a helpful message again from CCHQ?
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the other reasons I found it quite bizarre, the enthusiasm with which the Conservatives embraced this idea. I guess you grab whatever piece of flotsam is available when you're splashing around and the ship is sunk, but it doesn't make sense. I mean, like you said right at the beginning, the media will embrace that with great alacrity because they are very bored by a scenario in which it's really obvious what's going to happen. And that's ideal for the Labour Party. The longer this looks like an uncertain outcome, the better for them, because that's exactly where they want the messaging space to be. So it's very odd that the Prime Minister would say, yeah, that's the message I want to put out.
Yeah, I think you're right. They're just hanging on to it. It's just getting through the news cycle. That's all it is anymore.
I mean, surely a better attack line would be like, don't let them get such a massive majority. Don't let them get a landslide.
Yeah, you can sort of do that one at a candidate level. It's quite hard to do that at prime ministerial level. We're going to get absolutely thwacked. Come save me, please.
I do think a message that was don't give Starmer a free hand and a massive majority might be more effective now than the same message with Blair was in 97, because you know Blair's approvals were like plus 30, plus 40 at this point, whereas Starmer's a much weaker. So this idea of if you give him a stonking great majority or do things you don't like, it might land rather better in the current environment than it did back then.
Yeah, I think it's just quite hard for the Prime Minister to say, but certainly your media friends could do that for you if they were so inclined, but they don't seem to be inclined to be very helpful at the moment. So.
No.
Rob, we are now at our quickfire round. And the first question to you is, who, alive or dead, would you like Keir Starmer to put in your fantasy cabinet?
What Starmer seems to be looking for is big, heavy-hitting figures with natural authority, working-class roots, good links to the business community, good links to Europe, where we've got to make some difficult negotiations and so forth. And for all of those reasons, I have landed on Thomas Cromwell, or at least the Hilary Mantel version of Thomas Cromwell. Guy with lots of experience, great track record in governments, great institutional reformer as well, and of course very good at getting money for the government when it needs it, which is also something that the Starmer government will be looking for. And I'm putting him in as sort of minister without portfolio with a roving brief, and essentially just send him in to any ministry where they seem to be underperforming to scare the living daylights out of whoever happens to be the cabinet minister in charge at the time.
Yeah, but he did lose his head at the wrong moment. So, Second question, what's the one issue not getting enough airtime that you think Labour needs to bring up its policy agenda?
I think they are paying attention to it, but I hope they will follow through on it, because I think it's one of the big issues that could get lost in the sort of rush of daily news cycles and so on, is citizenship and political rights. We haven't had a proper wide-ranging reform of citizenship laws in this country for 43 years since the British Nationality Act 1981. There are all sorts of tangles and problems with the current system, which produced, for example, the Windrush crisis. There are millions of people who've been living here for decades who don't have political rights. And the public opinion on all of this is very clear. If people have been here for 3 to 5 years and they've been making their contributions, working and paying their taxes, they should have access to the same social and political rights as everybody else. And that emphatically isn't the system we have right now. I mean, I know they have said stuff about this, so I don't want to be too unfair on them on that front. But I'm just hoping that they will follow through on that, because it strikes me as an area that could easily get sort of blown onto the next week tray week after week after week, because it's never quite the most urgent thing.
Do you think that would blunt their "we're being really tough on immigration" sort of vibe?
I don't think it need to, because it depends on the nature of the reform. You could combine a generous offer for those who've been here for a while and contributed with more coherent rules for example, deciding who gets to come, removing people and stuff like that. So there's no reason why you couldn't have a combination of generosity for those who play by the rules with tough enforcement for those who don't, which is really where the public are.
And final question to you, Rob. What is the ultimate power test that you would set Keir Starmer?
I'm going to reveal my true colours as a dyed-in-the-wool YIMBY centrist dad here, because I feel that the clearest, most obvious, easiest to judge metric for the new government is getting more housing built. Yeah. Getting more housing built in general, getting more council housing built, getting the rate of home ownership up, getting the cost of buying a house for first-time buyers down. These are easy metrics to judge a government on. This is something the Starmer team have said they want to make big changes on. It's an area where I know both of you have discussed it in the past as well, where what the problem is not difficult to identify. It's a lack of political will in grasping the nettle of solving that problem that has been government in, government out, the problem. So if you've got a Labour government with a serious mandate and serious power, that's the test. Fix that. We've been trying to fix that for 30 years. No one's managed it. So pass that test and I'm happy.
As a fellow Yimby centrist ad, I could not agree. Well, except I'm not really centrist anymore. I'm like, everyone else has moved so far to the right that I'm now wildly left wing. But, you know, I used to be centrist.
You're like a Green Party person now.
I am, however, still Yimby.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that. And if you are not a member of the Paratest crew, you can head to the paratest.co.uk or the paratest.substack.com. You'll get episodes ad-free and early before anyone else. And there's also an exclusive chance to be part of the podcast and lots more. Also, do get involved with us. If you've got any questions or comments or like ideas you'd like us to explore, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us on pod@theparatest.co.uk. You can also get involved on social media as well.
And we've also got our brand new YouTube channel, which is a Power Test Pod, and you can find clips on there. The Power Test only exists because of the amazing support from you, our members, and our supporters. And we're also delighted to have the backing of some brilliant organisations like the Future Governance Forum, which is providing intellectual and practical infrastructure vital to the revival of progressive government in the UK, and the Centre for Progressive Policy, a think tank championing inclusive economic growth. We're also really glad to have support from the Institute for Global Change, who provide us with exceptional research and briefings, and also partner with the fantastic Labour List, bringing to life many of the issues, themes, and discussions we're covering on the pod.